This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. Our topic is employment law. We're focusing on the rights of employees under the National Labor Relations Act, that's NLRA, regarding unions, wages, hours, and working conditions. My guest, Jill Kaufman, Regional Director of the National Labor Relations Board, Region 20 in San Francisco. Bruce Harland, union attorney and shareholder in the Alameda, California law firm of Weinberg, Roger, and Rosenfeld. And Thomas Lenz, Vice Chair of the Executive Committee of the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar, employer's attorney and partner in the Cerritos and Pasadena, California law firm of Atkinson, Andelson, Loya, Rood, and Romo. This segment of Your Legal Rights is funded by the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar of California, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, and by the National Board of Trial Advocacy, which also funds the public radio satellite transmission of the program. I welcome you to the program. Wonderful to have you here. And Tom has his daughter, Hannah, who is here with us in the studio listening to the program. It's wonderful to have a 16-year-old here. Jill, if you would, start the program off, if you would. Tell us a little bit about the National Labor Relations Act and the role of the National Labor Relations Board, if you would.
I'd be happy to, and I'm so glad that I have a chance to come talk to people about the National Labor Relations Board. The National Labor Relations Act became law back in 1935. And was upheld by the Supreme Court and found to be constitutional back in 1937. So it's a law that's been around for 80 years now. Mm-hmm. The Act, in a nutshell, protects employees' rights to engage in protected concerted activities and union activities. And the idea behind the law was that in the 1930s, coming out of the Great Depression, the president and Congress felt that it was important that employees have a stronger ability to band together and take collective action to balance out the power that employers held. In addition, there was a lot of labor strife at the time that impacted interstate commerce. And mm-hmm. so the act was around to provide stability in labor relations and increase employees' bargaining power. So the National Labor Relations Board is an independent federal agency that enforces the act. So we enforce the employees' rights to engage in these collective activities. Now, that's just the very summary form of what we do.
What employees or what level of employees are not covered, are not protected by the National Labor Relations Act?
So we protect, we have jurisdiction over private employers. We do not have jurisdiction over public employers.
Okay, so the government, any public employee, whether city, state, federal, is not covered?
That's correct.
Really?
Right.
With one unusual exception.
This is Tom.
The Postal Service.
That's correct.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yes.
Why is it covered and not other federal agencies?
Part of the Postal Reorganization Act.
Oh, really? Okay. Special act.
Yes. Yes.
All right. So,
and then we don't cover supervisors either, or independent contractors, farm workers. Am I missing any?
Racing, dog racing.
You're joking. You're joking.
I'm serious.
You're serious. Oh, my gosh. Bruce.
Or if you're just one employee at an employer, you can't join a union. It has to be...
Because it's not concerted.
It's not concerted. It's not collective.
Oh, that's very interesting. So essentially, correct me if I'm wrong, the National Labor Relations Act and the role of the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, deals with employees who are together in a union type of situation?
It does cover that, but employees don't actually have to be in a union situation to have rights under our act.
Give us a simple example, would you?
Let's see. We've handled cases where there were a group of roofers working in Fresno on a commercial building, large roof.
Non-union. Okay.
The temperature was up in the 90s. These guys were working out there, and the employer did not provide any shade or any water that day. So during their morning break, The guys come down from the roof, and a couple of them suggest to their coworkers, you know, we're not going to go back up. And when mm-hmm. break time's over, we're going to stay down here. We're going to demand that the owner come out and talk to us, or that we have some water and shade.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, break ends. Foreman tells them to get back up on the roof. The guys refuse and explain what they want. The owner does come out and fires the two guys who instigated
the instigators, yeah.
So when we investigate charges that are filed with us alleging that an employer has discriminated against people based on their protected concerted activity.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, the roofers were engaged in protected activity because they were talking about their working conditions. They were trying to improve their working conditions.
Mm-hmm.
It was concerted because it was a group action, and they were taking action to
improve.
So that's
what concerted means, a group action. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
And the employer fired them because of that.
And what happened with that case?
It eventually settled. And the remedies that we seek in that type of case would be reinstatement of the employees
yes.
to their jobs
yes.
and back pay, that they be made whole from for the time that they were out of work.
How long did that case last?
That one settled right after our investigation. So from the time the charge was filed to the time of settlement was probably 2 months.
Really? That's very good.
Now, if cases are litigated...
That's fast moving, yeah.
If cases are litigated, yeah. Things can take years.
Would you do this for us, Jill, because most of us are not that familiar with what the role of the NLRB. If there is I'm going to use lawsuit, which I'm used to, but if there is a dispute between a group of employees and their employer, this doesn't go into a court. It goes before the NLRB,
does it not? That's right.
So there's an administrative hearing?
Yes.
And then a result of the administrative judges, I presume.
Right.
Can that be appealed?
Yes. So the process starts with an investigation in a field office, and that's where I work. I work in a regional field office.
In San Francisco.
In San Francisco. And we conduct a neutral investigation. So we would take evidence from those employees who have filed a charge and speak to whatever witnesses we feel we need to make a decision.
Mm-hmm.
Ask the employer for its evidence, its side of the story, and then make a decision about whether or not there's been a violation. If we believe there's been a violation, we issue a complaint, and we change hats and become prosecutors.
I see.
So somebody, when they file a charge with us, they don't need to have an attorney represent them. We handle the investigation, and then we prosecute the case.
Mm-hmm.
And that's before an administrative law judge. The ALJ's decision can be appealed to the 5-member board and headquarters.
So that's the next level of the NLRB. That's
right.
Like an appellate level of the NLRB.
Yes, and those 5 board members are appointed by the president.
But president of the United States?
Yes.
I see, okay. And so it can go up to the 5-member board. And where is the 5-member board? Where are they located?
In Washington, D.C.
Oh, they are, okay. Mm-hmm. So if the 5-member board comes to a conclusion, which is favorable to the employees, but the employer or employers involved are not happy with that. Can they appeal that further?
They can. They can appeal it to the circuit courts, to the Circuit Court of
Appeals. Federal Circuit Court?
Yes. And if it's a case arising in Northern California, they could appeal to it depends on where the employer is doing business. They could appeal to the Ninth Circuit or to the D.C. Circuit.
I see. Mm-hmm. I see. Very interesting. What about, Tom, let me come to you. There's been a lot of news coverage about Uber lately and its drivers, et cetera. One of the big issues I think that Uber has faced, and I'm no aficionado about Uber, but is independent contractors. Can you talk a little bit about this and what is, how does the NLRA and the NLRB deal with this? And I know in your very early career, you were an attorney for the NLRB.
Yes, I worked for the National Labor Relations Board in Los Angeles for 3.5 years before I went into practice, and I've been with my same firm ever since now for 25 years. And As far as the National Labor Relations Board and independent contractors, I can't speak specifically to Uber.
I know you're not involved.
I'm not privy to those details.
Yeah.
But
okay.
As far as the independent contractor issue, it is a very hot topic, not only at NLRB, but with many agencies and in many courts across the country. There is an issue of misclassification, of wage theft, and with the National Labor Relations Board, it is an issue of deprivation of the rights of employees under the statute, under the National Labor Relations Act. Mm-hmm. If you are truly an independent contractor, you do not have the right to form, join, or organize a labor union. You do not have the right to discuss or take action on wages, hours, and terms and conditions of employment the way an employee would.
Would you define for everyone, very briefly, what does it mean to be an independent contractor? How does that differ from someone who is an employee?
An independent contractor is someone who holds themselves out as being a business person. They have their own enterprise.
I see.
For example, you own and operate a radio station, and one day your sinks don't work, so you call the plumber. That plumber is an independent contractor because it's not part of your ordinary course and scope of business.
I see. But go ahead. I interrupted you.
Oh, no. The independent contractor issue is a very common one, especially where you have a business that perhaps interacts with individuals who do the exact sort of work that business is established to do in whole or in part, and relies upon people they consider independent contractors or more loosely as 1099s. And if these individuals are reliant on that sole business as the source of their earnings, their business, then and they're under the control of that business exclusively or significantly, then I think there's a big issue as to whether those individuals are employees rather than truly independent business people.
Wasn't there relatively recently some litigation going on with one of the chain food restaurants about whether or not their workers were independent contractors or employees, or am I getting it mixed up with something else?
Well,
I was thinking whether it was McDonald's or Bruce is nodding.
Bruce is Bruce.
If you wouldn't mind, Bruce, what do you recall? What was this about?
Well, I think if you've read the newspapers or watched the news, you see the Fight for 15, which is a massive organizing campaign of fast food workers across the country.
Yes.
And it not only involves McDonald's, but, you know, the other ones that we have around here, In-N-Out Burger, Carl's Jr.'s, Arby's, any
so what
kind
was
of
fast
food.
So what was the basic issue there? Now, these people were like waiters, waitresses, et cetera.
Yeah, the issue there was not misclassification, but whether or not McDonald's, as the franchisor, was also a joint employer with the franchisee. Did McDonald's control the terms and conditions of employment of the workers that worked at the franchisee?
And so the franchisee was a separate, supposedly a separate entity from the major corporation McDonald's. Was that the point?
That's the defense, right?
And
so if any unlawful actions happen at the franchisee and McDonald's is considered a joint employer, they would be responsible jointly for any of those unlawful practices. So if there were remedies like Jill was talking about, McDonald's corporate would be responsible for it. That is being kind of fought out in...
It still is?
Yeah, in a massive NLRB hearing that's covering multiple regions. I think Region 21
is
involved.
So actually, a number of these particular cases or employers, I'll refrain from saying anything about because we have
cases
pending.
It's investigated. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, we got that. Tom, let me come back to you for a moment. When we were preparing to go on the air just a few minutes ago, you talked about misclassification, the mere act of a misclassification of someone who is working at some position is considered unlawful. Would you give us an example of what that is?
Sure. The National Labor Relations Board has, in the last couple of years, looked at this trend, this issue of independent contractor misclassification, and they have said that the nature of misclassification is to consider someone not to be an employee, and by considering someone not to be an employee, you are stripping them of the rights to unionize and to discuss wages, hours, and working conditions. And therefore, in the eyes of the agency, as a prosecutor, they are considering the act of misclassification itself, designating someone, an independent contractor rather than an employee, to be an illegal act, an unfair labor practice. So there has not yet been a ruling, to my knowledge, on that issue, but the Labor Board is seeking such a ruling in the cases it is currently prosecuting.
And we are talking, when you talk about the Labor Board, National Labor Relations Board, we're talking about nationally here.
Correct.
Not just California.
Correct.
So this discussion that we're having now is really federal law across the United States.
Yes.
Although here in California, I had what I believe was the very first case in which the National Labor Relations Board took that position.
Really?
Yes.
When did you have this case?
About 2 years ago.
No kidding. Really, that's very interesting. Let me, a couple of things I want to have you all know. We are doing this program live on Wednesday, June 14th. And I'm going to give you a toll-free number that you can call in just a few minutes. We will be taking calls in the second half hour of the program. It's toll-free 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255, whether you are in California or wherever you might be, because we are on the Internet at www.kalw.org. Also, for those of you who are interested, we do every month, usually the fourth Wednesday of the month, what we call a lawyer night, where I will have several attorneys who are in the conference room here at KALW Public Radio in San Francisco who will be taking calls off the air between 7 to 8 p.m., that's Pacific time, when you can speak with an attorney off the air while I'm doing the live program with guests in the studio, and we're on the air with people calling also on the air. And so that's our next, on June 28th is our next Call a Lawyer Night, and you are invited, whether you listen to the program live or delayed, you're invited, and that number is 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917, and that will be on Wednesday evening, June 28th, from 7 to 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Let me come to you, Bruce, if I may. Employer policies and handbooks. This is something that I think you are very much involved with. What are you talking about here?
Yeah, well, if you work for a living, you know your employer probably has some kind of policy or handbook that they put.
You would hope the employer does, yeah.
Depending on what's in it. But anybody, who applies for a job gets hired. First day of work, you come in and they give you a big handbook, like 150 pages long, and say,
is that what it's becoming now?
Yeah, these handbooks are really,
and
really.
And the employer is hoping that you won't read it? Is that the idea? Sorry, Tom. Sorry.
If I'm advising them, they're not 150 pages. They're way shorter than that.
I couldn't help it. Go ahead.
But these are huge volumes. And, you're asked to sign the handbook. And most people, I know I would, just toss it in the backseat of their car.
Or use it in the trunk. Put it in the trunk, yeah.
Use it for some kindling in the fire.
Oh, you are naughty, aren't you? Yeah, I've heard about you.
But the good union lawyers always ask for those handbooks because they want to see what's in them.
I don't blame them.
And the active workers, too, want to know what's in them and see what they have to live up to. And what you find is a lot of overly broad policies. So, for example, you have policies known as the happy workplace. No one can say anything bad about anybody in this workplace. And if you do, you're in trouble. Even terminated. And so somebody says something bad about their supervisor. Somebody says something bad about the company because it's not paying them fairly.
When you say something bad, by talking to your coworker
talking to your coworker, yes.
Really?
Yes.
I mean, my boss is really a louse.
Yes.
Would that be bad?
That would not fit into the happy workplace culture. And or posting on social media, for example. You know, you have a tough day at work because your boss yelled at you. You go home, you post something on Facebook and say, my boss is just the biggest jerk in the world. Hasn't he treated you guys like this in the past? You all know he's done it, and we need to do something about it. And then all their friends who work with them, who are their Facebook friends, start
doing the Facebook thing by adding their little bits and pieces.
And person comes back to work, and the boss says,
"Hey, you're fired.
I read your Facebook post. You're fired."
Bye.
Yes.
There's the exit.
Yes, and that would be an example of an overly broad policy to say that you can't say anything bad about your boss, your coworkers, or your work.
And that would be because that overbroad rule has a tendency to interfere with employees' rights to engage in protected concerted activity or union activity. The board would look at it and say that rule would chill employees and prevent them from engaging in activities that they have a right to engage in.
So what if someone, for example, and I can't use the word on the air, of course, in talking to his or her co-employees said, my employer is a you-know-what. Okay, I think you all know what I'm thinking about. Is that something that would be, Bruce, actionable as being in violation of the happy workplace policy of the employer?
Well, I mean, you're going to have to look at it in the context of what was said and who it was said to. But the board has issued some decisions out there, and you could fill in that blank with some pretty nasty language
and get away with it
yeah.
without being unlawfully fired.
Now I hear this often.
Okay.
I speak on panels and attend panel discussions, and I often hear, in particular, employer side attorneys complain that the board has issued these decisions. But when we investigate those cases or litigate those cases, we're often looking at the entire context, and so it's very fact specific. And one of the things we're going to want to know is, what type of language do people use in the workplace? Has somebody used this type of language before and the employer didn't do anything to them?
You're talking about if profanity has been used before and the employer has just kind of ignored it.
Right.
Okay.
And now maybe they're only doing it because the people are talking about working conditions on Facebook.
Yeah,
And so you have to get into a lot of facts before you make a decision.
Oh, boy. Boy, Tom, from the employer's standpoint, what?
There are big issues here in terms not only of the policy language, but the consistency of enforcement. When I see a handbook that is 100 or more pages, even anything over 50, I'm usually wondering, does anybody ever read this, including management, and is it ever followed in terms of the actions that are actually taken?
So how do you, as an employer's attorney, if your client, the employer, has this policy book that has 150 pages, and you are concerned about, has management even read it itself or themselves? How do you deal? How do you deal with your employer, client in something like this?
I want to do some background investigation to find out who prepared this handbook, when was it prepared, how has it been disseminated, is it reviewed with employees, is it referred to in the actions that management takes with employees, what is our past practice on whatever issue happens to be at hand, giving somebody a warning, firing somebody? Do we have consistency or inconsistency in how we've acted? Because I think ideally a handbook is there to establish some understanding of consistently applied policy. Mm-hmm. But it can actually be an employer's worst enemy if you profess something that you do not live by. And what I would hate to see is a situation where my client has a bad handbook, poorly written rules, rules it doesn't follow, and they're being presented with this handbook on the witness stand. These are your policies, right? Or are they? Mm-hmm. And you are looking at a situation of your client basically not looking very credible.
Let me ask you this. With regard to a handbook, I would assume that most modern employers, before actually making it available to their employees, their prospective employees, etc., would have something like this reviewed by their attorneys generally, or has that not been the history of this type of thing?
It varies from company to company, and some will do it annually, some will do it every couple of years, which at a minimum I would recommend. But there are some companies that have been using the same handbook for many years, or maybe they have something that corporate headquarters across the country prepared that is not California specific. And I think it's important to point out there are some policies that are required here in California. For example, every employer in California has to have an anti-harassment policy.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
And there are certain things that, depending on where you are, you need to have them, and they may need to be updated with changes in the law.
Even beyond handbooks, though, policies are a big issue because they could be orally promulgated as well. So you can have situations where a supervisor is investigating some conduct of an employee and issues discipline to that employee and tells the employee, you cannot talk about this at all with anybody. Again, that's a limit on their Section 7 rights to engage in concerted activity.
That's pretty heavy.
Or a situation where a supervisor in a non-union setting gives a wage increase or a wage decrease to an employee and says, you cannot talk to anybody about the how much you earn here at this company. And again, that's unlawful because it's an infringement upon their Section 7 rights to engage in concerted activity.
We're nearly ending the statewide version of the program, which is the first half hour. Let me ask you this. If someone is demoted or terminated for one of these things that you've been talking about, and the NLRB gets involved, what can the NLRB do, Jill, in terms of an investigation and a result?
Well, once we investigate, if we find that there has been a violation of the National Labor Relations Act and we issue a complaint and we're going to litigate it, the remedy we seek is to restore the person to the status quo. So if they were terminated, we would seek to get their job back and we would seek back pay for them, make whole remedy. If it was discipline, have the discipline wiped off their record.
All right, everybody. I want to give you, if I may, our toll-free number and invite you to call in. My guests are incredibly experienced people in employment law, aside from the National Labor Relations Act and the National Labor Relations Board. So if you have some questions, please feel comfortable to call in. The toll-free number, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. 798-8255. Let me tell you who we have here because I think it's important that you know this. We have Jill Kaufman, who is Regional Director of the NLRB Region 20 in San Francisco. Bruce Harland, union attorney, and he's a shareholder in the Alameda, California law firm of Weinberg, Roger, and Rosenfeld. And Tom Lenz, Vice Chair of the Executive Committee of the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar, employer's attorney and partner in the Cerritos and Pasadena, California law firm of Atkinson, Andelson, Lawyer, Rood, and Romo. So please, if you do have questions or comments or would like to bring something to the attention of my guests, don't hesitate. We're doing this program live on Wednesday evening, June 14th, 866-798-8255. Support for KLW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The San Francisco Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation in both San Francisco and Marin County, and for a referral to a lawyer, or the Bay Area Mediation Services of the San Francisco Bar, call 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. If you're in San Mateo County, the San Mateo County Bar Association also has a lawyer referral service. You can call your own during normal business hours at 650-369-4149. That's 650-369-4149. Nearly every county in California has a bar association and lawyer referral service. You can call your own. tell them what the problem is, and they'll do their best to find an experienced attorney to meet with you for a half an hour consultation, and with minor exception, for a half an hour consultation with an attorney, you'll pay somewhere between $25 to $35. That money does not go to the attorney. It goes to the lawyer referral service to keep it going. It's a great consumer service. I hope you don't need it, but at least you know it's there. One of the other things that I'd like you to be aware of, so that you might, if you're interested in learning more about the National Labor Relations Board, here's its website, which is a very good and very comprehensive website if you'd like to jot that down, www.nlrb.gov, www.nlrb.gov. And I have a question here that was brought in to me by Martin, who helps me on the program. One of these listeners called in, and here it is. In a workplace where the employer operates or contracts with a vendor to operate, surveillance for protection of the site and the workers, is there an obligation for the employer to notify employees video and or other means are in effect? In other words, there's a video camera, whatever, or in other effects, for employees' protection, question mark. If the security is also used in-house to observe the workers on the job, is there further obligation to notify the workers? In other words, can we conduct ourselves in a way that where we don't have to worry if anybody is looking at us? Does anybody, Bruce, you want to respond to that?
Well, certainly the employer could not use the video to spy on the workers as they engage in protected,
so you have to let the workers know you're doing this.
They don't have to let the workers know that they're video in a non-union setting, but they can't use the video to spy on them as they engage in protected, concerted activity. Here's the power of unions. When you have a union, security cameras are a negotiable subject with the employer. So mm-hmm. the employer has to negotiate with the union about the security cameras, what their video mm-hmm. footage is used for. Can it be used for discipline? Is it just used to make sure nobody comes into the property late at night and steals things, where they're placed? So when you have a union, you can negotiate about that. But in a non-union setting, you don't have any right to negotiate about that. The That's only protection there is that that video footage couldn't be used so the employer could spy on workers engaging in protected, concerted activity.
Let me throw this out, if I may. Jill Kaufman was talking about the situation with the roofers and where they were not provided water by their employer, there was no shade, etc., and they just weren't going to do it anymore. So instead of let's say, going further on that, what if the employer, and that was a non-union situation, what if that employer had posted some kind of hidden video cameras watching the roofers do their work to make sure they just weren't kind of sitting around smoking or doing whatever they were doing? Who would like to that's a non-union situation. Who would like to respond to that as to whether or not the hidden camera, the hidden video, was a violation of those roofers' rights? Or am I going too far? Tom, please.
I don't know that the cameras themselves would violate someone's rights. I think if they were used in a way that was trying to capture protected activity, or if they were used in a place where an employee would have an expectation of privacy. Mm-hmm. I mean, some employers have put cameras, for example, in the restroom, which
right.
is just ridiculous, but it's something that...
That could be a violation of the law.
That would offend, I think, most people's notions of privacy, that's something that would be inappropriate. But I think that in the workplace, employees expect to be monitored, they expect to be supervised, and the question is, I think, really consistency and, you know, what are people's mm-hmm. expectations in that place?
It is against the law to create an impression of surveillance, so you don't actually have to engage in surveillance or spying. So in that situation, if I change the hypothetical or fact pattern a little bit, and the boss had or the employer had some knowledge that, you know, every day at 4 p.m., the roofers went and met with a union organizer mm-hmm. in a particular spot.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next day he said, you know what, I'm going to put up a camera that focuses on that particular spot. Maybe it doesn't take any footage. Maybe it does. Mm-hmm. But that would either be the impression of surveillance of protected activity, or it would be surveillance of protected concerted activity.
And it would be a violation because it would have a tendency to chill employees. Employees are not likely.
Who might want to organize.
Right. And so employees are not as likely to engage in that activity anymore because they see the camera up there.
Well, let me give our toll-free number again, wherever you may be, either in California, if you're listening to the program on the internet at www.klw.org. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Please join us if you have a question or comment, something you'd like to bring to the attention of not only my guests, but the rest of the audience. Additional funding for your legal rights is made possible by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, the Family Law Section of the State Bar, the Trust and Estate Section of the State Bar, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. So, what about, I know, Bruce, before we went on the air, you discussed with us the joint employer staffing company issue and responsibility, joint employer responsibility, and you mentioned this might relate to nursing homes, it might relate with respect to the employment of housekeepers, people who cooked, et cetera. Could you talk a little bit about this, the joint employer and the staffing situation? First of all, define for us, what does staffing mean, the staffing company? Who is or what is the staffing company?
Sure, and it kind of relates back to what we talked about a little bit with McDonald's. But it's quite common that employers, especially in the field that I work mostly with, which is healthcare, for employers to contract out certain services because it's just cheaper.
This is like contracting for services with some kind of an agency who supplies.
It could be an agency that supplies temporary nurses, for example. Mm-hmm. It could be just a entity that provides a certain service that hospital or nursing home may need, like housekeeping.
Yes.
You know, they need housekeepers to come in and clean all of the rooms. They need cooks. You know, there's entities that provide cooks and dietary workers who come in and cook food for employers. And their business, you know, so what you see is, especially in smaller businesses like nursing homes, those classifications contracted out. If a worker wanted to organize a union and they belong to that entity that just did the housekeeping, but they actually physically work in the nursing home, then usually, you know, if they nobody controlled their wages other than the entity that they worked for, then you'd have to have an election with that housekeeping employment entity. Mm-hmm. But the joint employer issue comes up where the nursing home or an employer has control over the terms and conditions of employment of the contracting entity's employees. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the nursing home says, you can give me five housekeepers, but you can't pay them more than $8, more than $10 an hour. Mm-hmm. You can't give them a pension. You know, they only get certain amount of days off. They have to wear a certain uniform. Our supervisors are going to tell them when to come and when to go. And you face a joint employer situation there where the nursing home and the housekeeping agency are a joint employer, and they are liable for any unfair labor practices. And they also become responsible to bargain both, mm-hmm. bargain a contract mm-hmm. with the union if the union wins an election mm-hmm. and represents the employees.
That's
there.
That's very interesting. I mean, Tom, you want to say something?
Yeah, this has been a very controversial development in the law. There have been a couple of important rulings over the last few years from the National Labor Relations Board that have truly expanded the risk for employers that do business in a let's say, a joint fashion with a staffing company, a joint venture, or so forth, so that those multiple employers could share that liability and also share the potential to be jointly organized. It used to be the case where if a union tried to organize two employers together and I represented one of them, I could tell the National Labor Relations Board, we don't consent to be part of a joint representation scheme, and that would be the end of it. But with a recent ruling, the Labor Board said, we are not going to take employer consent into account anymore. It's going to be really the facts of the situation. Are these two businesses or more employers, and do they share either actual control or the potential for control?
I see.
And we will see in this new administration whether there will be changes to that rule. There's already been a lot of pushing on that.
When you say this new administration, you're talking about President Trump's administration.
That's correct.
I see. Okay. Let me just mention to all of you, whether you listen to the only the half hour or the full hour, if you're interested in hearing the full hour, it is available as a podcast free of charge. If you'd like to jot down the website, it's www.kalw.org/subscribe. That's a free podcast at www.kalw.org/subscribe, and that will be available tomorrow on that website if you are interested. Jill, let's take a call from Jack, and then I want to come to you, Jill. Jack, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi there.
Hi.
Thank you for having the show. It's very, very compelling. So I am a retired management consultant, but now driving for Uber. And from my experience, it seems like they're much more of a employer-employee relationship than as I've been in the past when I've been in a contractor relationship. And so I'm wondering, on the one hand, are there real key bright lines that define when somebody is an employee, when somebody is a contractor? And you may have said this and I missed it because I got in late. But the second thing is, I noticed one of the things that Uber does is they tell you you can accept rides if you want to. And as a quotes partner or contractor, you would think you would have that right.
I'm sorry, Jack. Say that again. I didn't quite understand that. Say that again.
If you're a driver for Uber, and I'm sure it's the same for Lyft and so forth, you get a request to pick somebody up.
Yes.
A little thing lights up on your phone and beeps, and you can either accept it by tapping the phone, or you can not do anything and it'll go away, which means that you don't accept it. Now, you would think, as an independent business partner, contractor, you know, it's completely up to you. But what Uber does, for example, is if you don't accept three trips in a row, they turn you off. They turn off the application so you can no longer get trips. And I'm wondering, you know, with these other guidelines about what determines employee versus contractor, how that fits in with mix.
Thank you very much for that question. Can Jack turn his radio back up?
Sure.
Okay, Jack, thanks for calling, and we're going to hear from Tom right now, so turn your radio back up if you would.
I'm going to try to distill some very complicated stuff into a short answer. The independent contractor test has been a multi-factor test formulated in different ways by different government agencies at state and federal levels. Some people have referred to it as a 20-factor test, and I would say by and large those factors have been largely the same. And a lot of it goes to, are you an independent business operation? Do you accept or reject work? Do you have the ability to work when you want to, and so forth? And the way that the law has been developing, it's been changing in the last few years to one of more reliance. You may have your own business license. You may file your own corporate taxes. You may hold yourself out as being a business. But if you are truly dependent on one organization for your work, be it Uber, be it Lyft, be it something completely different, if there is that dependency on that one entity, that itself might make you not so independent, but more dependent, therefore more
under the control
and misclassified as an employee. So that's not to say that you are one or the other, but the tests have aligned up more in recent years with dependency rather than multiple factors. And to make things even more confusing, the Department of Labor, which is distinct from National Labor Relations Board, rescinded some guidance on the dependency test, and we will see where the National Labor Relations Board chooses to go. But dependency rather than multiple factors has been the trend.
If you as Jack is talking about, as an Uber driver, if he depends on Uber to send him, here's your ride, here's your other ride, here's your ride, then that's what we're talking about, is a... He's no longer really an independent contractor.
And the sort of activity in the cases I've been handling, you may say that you can work for a lot of different people. You may say that you have the ability to choose the work or to do it or not to do it. But if there are repercussions and if you are truly reliant on one source of income and work, that might lead a government agency to say, hey, wait a minute, this person is an employee, not a contractor.
Okay. Jill, let me come to you for just a minute and ask you, certainly not with respect to Jack's question, but if someone, just generally speaking, if some one or more persons in some kind of concerted activity, maybe they want to organize a union or maybe they want to do something like that, and they feel that they're being oppressed by whomever they're working for, what is the mechanism, basically speaking, for them, if there is such, to file perhaps a complaint with the NLRB or whatever? Would you mind briefly telling us that?
Sure. People, we are not a self-initiating agency, so we don't go out looking for cases.
All right. You are looking for someone to come to you,
exactly.
I presume.
And so we don't start investigating an issue until somebody files a charge with us. And the charge is just a one-page document.
Oh.
And somebody can do that either by going to the website nlrb.gov and filing a charge that way, or by calling a regional office and speaking with one of our board agents. Mm. And the board agent will help somebody file a charge.
Well, that seems like a pretty simple way to get it going.
It is. And you don't need an attorney to do it. An individual can
file a charge. Wait a minute. You're taking this away from the attorneys? Wait a minute.
We also have charges are also filed by unions and also filed by employers against unions.
Okay.
So we are a neutral agency.
Well,
we handle
good.
Charges against both unions and employers.
That's very important. Here's a question that was brought in regarding video cameras in the workplace. This is a follow-up to what we were talking about a few minutes ago. The employer's, this is singular possessive, the employer's intent is very difficult to prove. This is someone's sentence. If the employer openly admits his intent is to discourage union organizing or concerted activity, installing video cameras could be challenged, period. But what if he says it's for general security reasons to prevent theft, question mark? How can his real intent be proven?
That would be, in my view, a question of how the employer has implemented the camera usage and what's really gone into it. If the cameras are suddenly showing up after the union organizers show up, if the way the cameras are being positioned is changing after the union organizers show up or after there have been rumors of organizing activity, that's the sort of stuff that is going to, I think, be very important to the National Labor Relations Board.
Mm-hmm. And we actually have found violations in those types of cases where employees have engaged in protected concerted activity and the next day there are cameras out there. So we did find violations.
And remember, the NLRA doesn't just cover unionized workplaces. It covers non-union workplaces as well. And so it could be as simple as a couple employees are discussing something that happened about their workplace and they're upset about something. Or
if it wasn't a union employment place, could you give us a little more specifics so that we might be able to better understand?
Sure. Somebody was given a demotion,
mm-hmm.
and they complained to their coworker that they were given a demotion because they spoke up about a safety condition that they thought the employer needed to correct.
Could this be like in a mom and pop shop, a small small business operation?
Sure.
Like a small market or something?
Sure,
like that?
Absolutely.
Really?
Yeah, sure. You know, let's say one of the employees complained to the employer about a hazardous condition in mm-hmm. the workplace,
mm-hmm.
and the next day they were demoted. And if the employee, going back to the cameras, tying this into the cameras, if, and it's a non-union place, if the employer says, you know, I really don't want my employees talking about, you know, their working conditions with each other, I'm going to put a camera out.
Yeah.
To try to chill and discourage them from doing that, that's still a violation,
wow.
even in a non-union place.
Wow. The other way the camera may come up is not as an independent violation, but if employees were engaged in protected concerted activity like that and the employer fired one of the employees and a charge is filed with mm-hmm. us and we're investigating and the employer says, well, I didn't know anything about the protected concerted activity. That definitely wasn't the reason why, because I didn't even know they were engaged in protected concerted activity.
Mm-hmm.
We'd be very interested in knowing whether or not they have cameras, you know, and so that may tend to show that the employer had a way of finding out.
Well,
cameras are really, you know, old school, to use a phrase. You see a lot of spying with computers and emails and those things, you know. And so, you know, there were cases out there where the employer really wanted to know who wrote up that petition to say that they were a bad employer, a bad supervisor, and they go and they check computers to see who wrote the petition.
So in other words, they went to check computers that are in the place of employment being used by the employees.
Absolutely. And then take action based on what they found. Oh, Bruce, the troublemaker, wrote the petition. We're going to get rid of him.
Are you talking about Bruce Harlan?
I'm a junior. I'm talking about senior.
So in other words, let's go one step further. In an employment situation, if someone is assigned to a particular computer, and this is the company's computer or the business's computer, and that person says something negative about the employer, and the employer goes and is kind of suspect of this employee and goes and looks into the computer and sees this and demotes the employee or fires the employee, that is a violation of...
If the reason for the demotion or the termination is because the individual wrote the petition or wrote whatever was offensive to the supervisor...
That's very interesting, very, very interesting. Let me we have not even – there are some areas of the NLRA and the NLRB that we haven't even touched upon. We have just a very few minutes left. Is there something else, Jill, that you would like to bring forward that we haven't even touched upon?
The other thing that the NLRB does is conduct union elections. So
oh,
in
really?
Addition to handling unfair labor practices, the other part of what we do is petitions are filed with us by unions or employees to hold elections to determine whether
Is this mandatory across the United States?
Yes.
It is. Oh, how I didn't
yes.
know that.
Yes.
So you as a union, an organized union, if you're going to have an election, you have to petition or communicate with the NLRB to get permission to do so?
You would petition with us to have us come in and conduct the election.
I see.
So if the union actually wants to represent those employees and the employer has not voluntarily recognized the union,
I see.
The union could file a petition with us, with the National Labor Relations Board, and the government, as a neutral entity, will come in and conduct the election.
Very interesting.
There is much more to it than that. But that's another part of what we do.
Boy, oh boy. Tom,
Yes, that's a very important part of what the labor board does. When I worked there, it was communicated to us as agents that, you know, that was job number one, the most important function the agency does, to ascertain employee choice where questions are raised, to conduct the votes, assuming that an employer has not voluntarily agreed to accept a union as the majority mm-hmm. representative mm-hmm. of the employees. And the agency conducts elections both for unions to be voted in, what we call certification elections, or decertification when employees want to remove a union as their representative.
So, Joe, coming back to for a moment to the website that we've given a couple of times, the NLRB website, www.nlrb.gov. If someone feels that there's some violation that he or she or they are being subjected to by the employer, is there the form for petitioning to the NLRB, the one-page form on the website?
Yes, you can access the
form. So you can download it. Can you actually print it up on your computer and then send it, email it to the NLRB?
You can e-file it with us. I believe it can also be emailed, but I'm not certain of that. But it can be mailed,
really?
It can be faxed,
okay.
It can be
very
e-filed.
Very simple.
And then the website also has a great deal of information both for employees and for employers about the National Labor Relations
mm-hmm.
Act.
Mm-hmm. One thing I want to add, yeah, Chuck, Bruce, is please. That when a worker or a union files an unfair labor practice charge with the National Labor Relations Board or with the regional office of the National Labor Relations Board, they have to provide witnesses to support the charge. And those witnesses are interviewed by a board agent or a board attorney, and their interview is encapsulated in an affidavit.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole process is confidential unless the region authorizes a complaint and goes to trial. Then they have to turn over that affidavit to mm-hmm. the other side. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, those affidavits are never shared with the employer. Because most of the cases settle before going to trial.
Not just the affidavits, but even the names of the people that we've spoken with, we don't tell the parties who we've talked to.
Uh-huh. Okay. So there is a confidentiality. We are coming very close to the end of the program. Again, I want to give you the website for the NLRB. It's www.nlrb.gov. If you are interested in listening to the entire program, if you came in late or only heard a part of it or didn't hear anything at all, there is a free podcast, and you can get that www.kalw.org/subscribe. And so that's, I think we probably come to the end of obviously what we can talk about, because if we start doing more, we'll be cut off, and we can't do that. So we are. I'm very pleased that you were able to make it, the three of you, and also you, Hannah, for joining us, Tom's daughter, for joining us here and listening to this program. I want to thank you very much for joining us, Jill Koppen, Regional Director of the NLRB Region 20 in San Francisco, Bruce Harland, union attorney, thank you so much for joining us. Tom Lenz, thank you so much. I work a great deal with Tom. He has been an incredible help to me in this last couple of years with topics and guests for labor and employment law programs. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Chuck.
I appreciate the three of you coming here, and you too, Hannah, for coming here. Next time on Your Legal Rights, our program will be on estate planning, focusing on advance directives and when someone you love won't create an advance directive. My guests will be Peter Stern and John Martin, specialists in estate planning, trust, and probate law, certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization, and California Superior Court Judge Eugene Hyman, who's retired. That's next time on Your Legal Rights. This segment of Your Legal Rights has been made possible by the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar of California. Also by the National Board of Trial Advocacy, which also funds the public radio satellite transmission of the program for national distribution. I hope you enjoyed listening to the program, and I hope you will join us next time on your public radio station when we will do more about what's important for you in your life. I'm Chuck Finney.